Trust Company v. Simmering. Mr. Patton.
May it please the Court, at issue in this appeal is two concepts. First, what is a RICO-related law in the guarantee? And second, the mend-the-hold doctrine. The Simmerings have two arguments for reversing the judgment that they had defaulted on their personal guarantee to the bank by being charged under a RICO-related law.
They defaulted in a million ways. I don't know what you're doing here.
Well, Your Honor, the district court found that they had violated a RICO-related law. So
That's not their only default.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's also the mend-the-hold doctrine.
I don't think it's applicable.
Well, I think that's one of the issues that we're here to discuss today. So we think that there
also,
are two...
RICO-related is defined very broadly. It includes any law that involves forfeiture of assets.
Yes, but what the agreements provide is that you have to have formal charges, and that there's no evidence in this record of the charges. We know of the pretrial diversion, but we don't know what the charges were.
But obviously there was a charge if there was a guilty plea, and there was a potential penalty for that offense, which is forfeiture of assets. What has worried me is that you, in the brief, you focus on whether there was conviction, which would be necessary for the actual penalty of asset forfeiture. But I can't see why that's relevant to the question as to whether that was a potential rather than actual penalty.
Yes, Your Honor. What we're saying here is we don't know what the charges were. We know what the pretrial diversion relates to, but that there is no evidence of the charges, and the guarantee says that
he must have been charged with something that
he was charged with something.
Don't interrupt me. He must have been charged with something that gave rise to a potential penalty of forfeiture of assets.
No, Your Honor.
He wouldn't have forfeited his assets.
Your Honor, he did not forfeit any assets.
It doesn't matter. The question is there a potential penalty? Can he face a potential penalty of forfeiture of assets?
The simple answer is we don't know from this record because the charges are not in the record. What we do know is the pretrial conversion related to theft. And as such, we don't know what... I mean, many times people plead to one thing but are charged with something else.
But all that's required is the charges be filed under law or under a law that provides the potential penalty of forfeiture of assets.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's what happened here.
Well, with all due respect, we don't know what the charges were. We do know what the pretrial diversion was. I mean, also the pretrial diversion is not a conviction under Kentucky law.
You know, it's not required. The contract doesn't require a conviction.
Right.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what we don't, as I say, is what we don't know is what the charges were, because you can plead guilty.
That's a separate point. I don't know why you bring in the conviction. You did it in your brief also.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're really skirting with sanctions for frivolous arguments.
Well, what we see in this case, Your Honor, is a lack of record evidence as to what the charges were in Kentucky. That's the
charges in Kentucky were 11 counts of theft by deception.
No, we know that's what the pretrial diversion was to, but we don't know what the charges were.
Well, what would the charges have been? Dancing in the street?
Well, we do know that people can plead guilty to something differently than what they were charged with. It's a simple matter for the bank to have gotten the charging documents and present them in this record. And by not having done that, so the question I would ask is, where in the record does it show what Mr. Simmering was charged with? We also know that theft is a Class D felony, and forfeiture is not a penalty for that. So you have to look at the underlying what the charge was and what was the potential penalty for that. In this case, for example, forfeiture was not a potential penalty for theft under Kentucky law. Also, the bank did not...
Not even a potential penalty?
Not for theft, Your Honor. It's a Class D felony under Kentucky law. And it's only if the assets were used in theft related to that. And in this case, there was no property in Kentucky that was at issue. The property at issue is in Indiana and Louisiana. So there's no potential forfeiture.
The statute your opponent cites on page 13, section 514, period 130, upon the conviction of any person for the violation of any offense in this chapter, which they say includes theft by deception, all property held in violation of this chapter, etc., shall be forfeited.
Well, in this case, because there was pretrial diversion, there's not the conviction.
Yeah, you're back with a conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, because unless there's the conviction, there can't be the forfeiture.
But the loan agreement...
That's not what the contract says. The contract is about potential penalty. And you agreed that it didn't have to be a conviction. It just has to be a charge under a statute where asset forfeiture is a potential penalty. Now, they say on page 13 that includes theft by deception. Now, is that incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor, because under Kentucky law, theft is a Class D felony, and as such, there's no forfeiture for that.
That's very strange. You mean you can keep what you've stolen?
No, you cannot keep what you've stolen, Your Honor. But if in this case there was pretrial, I guess I'm getting around in circles here.
Can you keep what you've stolen?
No.
Well, why isn't that a forfeiture of assets?
Well, there are other statutes that speak to that issue and also cited by the district court, but that are unrelated to forfeiture. The district court cited a number of statutes there.
Maybe we should talk about the other basis for summary judgment. I mean, it's undisputed that three borrower entities file for bankruptcy, and that alone would constitute an event of default. And it appears that the Indiana state courts have already determined that the loans are in default.
Your Honor, that relates to the mend the hole doctrine, which, as this court set forth in its opinion in the Harbor Insurance versus Continental Bank Corporation case, is an Illinois doctrine which binds the bank to the ground upon which it files its complaint. The bank's complaint did not raise the bankruptcy issue.
No, it doesn't say you have to have all. No, what it says is you can't sue for breach of contract on one claim, and when that's knocked down, you say, oh, well, I have other claims as well. You have to... You can't do that. It doesn't mean you can't add additional grounds.
Well, the bank's original complaint was along the grounds of relates to a misapplication of $108,000 of insurance proceeds that was placed towards undue principal rather than interest in escrow accounts. So there's an issue about payment and a dispute between CPAs as to whether payment had been made. So that was the ground upon which the complaint was filed. And then afterwards, additional arguments were raised. So we do think it does, the whole document does bind the bank to the initial grounds raising its complaint. For instance, the Kentucky issue occurred over...
Are you saying you can never amend a complaint in a breach of contract suit?
No, they could have amended the complaint and chose not to do so. For instance, the ground upon which the district court ruled in this case was the Kentucky issue, the pretrial diversion. That occurred 1 year before the filing of the complaint. Your Honors, I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve some
okay,
time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Patton. Mr. Roberts?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is John Roberts. I'm here on behalf of First Bank and Trust Company of Illinois. The only issue that was raised in the district court was whether the borrower and on the loans was in default. Here, as addressed in the briefs, there are a number of ways in which these borrowers were in default, and as a result, the guarantee was triggered. And whether it's based upon the default that was determined by the district court or for the reasons not actually ruled upon by the district court, summary judgment was properly granted. First, with respect to RICO-related default, under the loan documents, one of the defaults and is a default due to the filing of formal charges by... Yes, and Your Honor, what was put into evidence was a certified copy of the actual order, plea of guilty, and deferred sentencing, which said that the defendant moved to withdraw her formal, they thought Mr. Avram Simring was a her, formal plea of not guilty and to enter plea of guilty to, quote, theft by deception over $300, 11 counts. So he pled guilty to the charges, so therefore he had to be charged with them. And that's one of the requirements for diversion, is you plead guilty to the charges that are addressed to you. And this document establishes that he was charged with 11 counts of that theft by deception. In addition...
Well, Mr. Patton said that that theft by deception is just a Class D felony and there's no forfeiture.
In the statute we cited, it said that, and again, you've got to remember that what the contract says is it's not that he actually gets forfeiture, it's potential forfeiture. What it says is Section 514.130, upon the conviction of any person for the violation of any offense in this chapter being Section 514, which would include 514.040, all property held in violation of this chapter and any personal property, including but limited to vehicles, so on and so forth, and using the commission or furtherance of an offense under this chapter or in transportation of stolen property, shall be forfeited, as provided in KRS 500.90.
So the charge was one of the statutes incorporated there?
Section 514.040 is in Chapter 514, which will be included in under 514.130. And therefore, it's included within the where a potential for forfeiture existed.
I agree that there are, you know, many ways to find default, but one that you rely on, the building code violations, there's very little information in the briefs as to what even happened as to those violations. So how would that one be enough to support summary judgment?
I think, Your Honor, on that one, we'll rely on what we have in the briefs, but I think actually of all the defaults, that's probably not our strongest. I mean, I think the three that I think are most important to focus on here is the one that was granted in the district court, which is the filing of RICO charges, which, again, there could be no dispute. We've got a certified copy. These issues about charges weren't even raised in the district court. As a matter of fact, they called it a conviction when we were in the district court. But it doesn't matter because we meet the standard required by the contract. And as I said before, we can actually point to other defaults that this court never reached because it didn't have to, because it found this one that by definition was a default. In that regard, we have the interest in escrow that was unpaid. We've presented the testimony of an accountant that had gone through the entire loan history and established when they were in default. And his testimony was basically, it can't be disputed because the only thing they put up was the testimony of their expert in the Indiana foreclosure litigation, which, of course, I'll say in a minute, is actually collateral estoppel for this case. And in that circumstance, what was problematic about his opinions was that they necessarily had to misapply and ignore facts. And so we'd actually filed a motion in limine to exclude his testimony. In fact, because those facts, it was undisputed that he was basically counting or ignored checks that had bounced, had been returned for insufficient funds, and then he tried to pull back money that was received for insurance to somehow make up for defaults that prior existing as to interest in escrow payments. We also have the bankruptcy default. In that circumstance, Your Honor, with respect to that, we've submitted with respect to the take judicial notice the fact that even the Simmerings in the Indiana appeal in their reply brief acknowledged that this was a default. In fact, that in their reply brief they said, quote, CGC Bridgeway does not dispute the trial court's conclusion that a default occurred under the Bridgeway loan agreement and loan documents when borrowers Canico, Murph, and the Menorah filed their bankruptcy petitions. So, and then cites to the opinion in that Indiana trial court. So, again, there can be no question that that's a default. So now we've got three defaults for which there's no dispute of fact. But in addition, we now have collateral estoppel, because after we filed our motion for summary judgment, the trial court in Indiana rendered its opinion, concluding that there were defaults, the last two defaults I mentioned. And in that case, just to go through the history of this, we had actually agreed, the issue of default was so common among the cases that we had actually agreed that discovery taken in the Indiana case would be admissible in the district court here, and so we wouldn't duplicate it. Then, in response to our motion for summary judgment, the Simmerings stated that, quote, First Bank and the defendants are in litigation, i.e., Simmerings are in litigation in Indiana, acknowledging that they are the party in interest. They are in privity with the party in interest at a minimum, which is part of the collateral for the Bridgeway loan. In response to the motion limine I mentioned a moment ago, to bar their accountant expert, Stephen Thompson, because his opinions were all flawed, as found in the Indiana court, they said, quote, the testimony and documents used at trial in Indiana Circuit Court were the same, quote, were the same facts and issues were litigated that are before this court. In other words, there can be no question that they are collaterally estopped by the decision that was rendered in the Indiana court. Now, one of the things they originally argued was that since we didn't raise this in a reply brief and they didn't have an opportunity to respond to it, that maybe we had waived it or that. With respect to that, though, what happened was as soon as the decision came down and we filed a reply brief making the court aware of this, we then asked the court to basically stay everything in light of the fact that we now thought this was dispositive. The Simmerings' attorney was granted leave to file a surreply brief on this issue alone, agreed that that was okay, and, matter of fact, concluded that that's fair. Filed the surreply brief, and the only issue that was raised was that they were not collaterally stopped as to the two defaults that were not determined in the Indiana court, did not contest that they were collaterally stopped by the failure to pay principal or interest in escrow payments, and not contest that they were collaterally stopped by the bankruptcy finding. So now we know they're collaterally stopped, and you know, we've mentioned some cases in our briefs about showing when a owner of the property, which is key, that they are the owner of the entity. It's basically a sole proprietorship practically, where the Simmerings own it all. They are then in privity with the entity, and we've mentioned the Bartle case, which seems to be almost directly on point. Finally, and by the way, I will mention the Bartle case, although we've mentioned it both in the lower court and in our brief in this court, it's never been distinguished or even discussed by the other side. Finally, when we get to the issue of mend the hold, on that, for example, we've never repudiated our position. We've never changed our position. Our position has always been that they were in default. From the original default notice, we said that we're not waiving our right to claim other defaults. And, in fact, we later found out that there were additional defaults, which were raised not only on this litigation, but in the Indiana litigation. And for all these reasons, they are both in default for the RICO-related law. They're in default for the failure to pay interest in escrow pursuant to the loan documents. And they're in default for the bankruptcy filings, some of which they're actually collateral stuff from challenging. And finally, they do it a couple times to challenge the issue of damages, but that was never addressed to the trial court either. The district court, they actually agreed on our damage calculation. The only issue that was contested was default, and we now have at least three defaults, which there's no question, there's no dispute of fact.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Roberts. Mr. Patton, something further?
Just one point on rebuttal with respect to the Indiana foreclosure action. That was an action by the bank against an LLC, not the Simmerings. And the Simmerings are not...
What about his point that this Chapter 514 provides for forfeiture of assets for any violation of a statute that's in that chapter?
And if the Simmerings were charged with that violation, then that's then that language applies.
Well, they were charged with a violation of a statute that's in 514.
Well, I think the dispute is in with respect to the document the bank presented as to whether it shows that that charge was made.
Mr. Patton, and regarding that foreclosure, wasn't Cindy Simmering the sole owner?
No, that's an incorrect statement in the brief that's made by the bank. There were 10 partners. It's an LLC.
Is she one of them?
She is one of them.
Well, is she in privity?
No, she's not in privity. Just being, you have to break through the. I see that my time is up. My finishing.
You didn't finish the answer. I assume the judge. Those are alleged. Finish your answer.
Thank you. She's not in privity because it's a separate LLC and they're not breaking through, unless they're saying that they're alter ego, and they're not because they're separate partners, 10 other partners that I'm aware of. So.
Well, did Avram testify there, didn't he?
Yes, he did testify in the Indiana court.
Yeah.
The issue really is one of applying a judgment as to a note in state court as against a personal guarantee and against separate entities. And our position is that collateral estoppel would not apply. And in Indiana, there was a trial on the issue of the payment, whether the insurance proceeds were appropriately applied. And that's what we think is the appropriate resolution here, is to bind the bank to its initial complaint grounds and have a trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you to both counsel.